powerful as crack. By that time, the crowd had leveled off at about 80 people, but they were all ordering drinks and spending money. After I won that night again, Teray sat down next to me. He said, "Hey, I'm going to Virginia tomorrow. I got a show up there. You want to roll?" Instantly, the world just got a lot bigger than the Laugh House. I hadn't even considered the fact that there were other comedy clubs to perform at. I could be doing this every night. However, I can't. I told him reluctantly, "I got to work." "All right, I feel you." He walked away from the table and I sat there alone, watching the blue back of his shirt recede into the club, feeling like I'd just blown a big opportunity to make something of myself. Chapter 32. K-Hart quits his day job and never looks back. Actually, wait, he kind of goes back, but that's in chapter 98. God damn it. Did I just spoil it? Spoiler alert. I just spoiled what happens in chapter 98. That's all right. You'll be fine. After I won my 6th contest in a row, Toure approached me again. "Hey, I got a gig way out in Westchester, Pennsylvania. If you want to come with me this week, you can." "Man, I still got a job, you know? I feel you." "Hey, you can say no to someone once, and they may ask you again. You can even say no twice and get another shot. But 3 no's, you're definitely out." I was 1 away from being out. The job I loved so much was suddenly a prison. There was a whole world of comedy clubs out there, and I was missing out on them. If there were other amateur contests like this one, I could make a good living doing this. But even if there weren't, I could still make my rent and my food on $75 a week. I was so confident, the possibility that I'd lose a contest didn't even occur to me. Here's some things people might say to you when you decide to pursue your dream. "I know you're excited about this right now, but you can't make a living at it. Are you sure this is what you want to do? Take some time to really think about it. Hey, don't quit your day job. Stop dreaming. Be realistic, man. There's no money in it. It's not a smart choice. There's too much competition. You're not good enough." See, many people will tell you to ignore these doubters. Others will tell you to listen and then prove them wrong. That's what worked for me in those first 2 shows. But I'm going to recommend something better that I learned much later. Don't invite them into the conversation. You already know what you want to dedicate yourself to, so you don't need to ask for their approval. There's no need to seek external approval when you already have internal approval. That's why even though I had sought out everyone's advice about performing at the first open mic, I didn't ask anyone about quitting city sports to become a stand-up comedian. I just did it. It was all or nothing. I was ready to give this my all. I didn't want anyone to say anything to me otherwise. I was going to be a professional comedy amateur. Even though I made up my mind, there were a few people that I had to share the information with. People who made me nervous as hell. The managers of City Sports and my mom. When I gave my 2 weeks notice to City Sports, the manager Brandon, who'd been to the club to see me perform, he couldn't believe what I was saying. "Kev, are you serious right now? You want to become a comedian?" "Yeah, that's exactly what I want to be." "A comedian, Kevin? What's going on, man? You got a career here. You're good at this. All right, there's room to grow. You could get to corporate and be making $75,000 a year. You just going to throw all that away because you want an amateur night at some comedy club?" "Pretty much." "Hey, I'm going to be honest with you, Kev. I'm worried that you're letting this go to your head. I mean, you know you're headstrong. That's your problem." I didn't say okay this time. I said, "I know what I want to do with my life. I quit." Less than 2 months before, these same people had been encouraging me to try comedy because I was so funny. Today, they were telling me to stop doing it. They believed in me then. Now, suddenly, they didn't believe in me. I couldn't understand it at the time, but later I thought about it. See, the problem is, many people want you to do things up to the point where they lose control of you. See, as long as they're still your boss or your mentor or your partner or your good friend, it's fine. But if it starts pulling you away from them or making you more successful than them or keeping you too busy to see them as much, then your dream can become their threat. I knew who my real friends in my job were. People like Alice, because when I told her what I wanted to do, she supported me. "Keep going," she said. "You're going to make it. Go be a star." After I gave my notice, doubt definitely crept in. It wasn't going to be easy to live off my winnings from amateur night, especially since Toure probably wanted to let someone else win, or another comedian might show up with louder friends than mine. Who knows? Unfortunately, I didn't have to worry about this problem for long. When I went to the club to perform the next Thursday, they told me that the amateur competition had been canceled because it still wasn't bringing in enough money for the club. My entire life plan was made and destroyed in the space of a week. The fuck was I supposed to do now? Chapter 33, Receiving a License to Kill. I still needed to break the news to my mom. See, first I bombed the SATs. Then after that, I dropped out of community college. Now I left my job, abandoned my plan to become the Nike rep, and I switched to comedy, which, by the way, wasn't even going to pay my rent. She sacrificed so much for me, and I was about to disappoint her yet again. I don't want to go back to city sports, I explained nervously. I really want to just give this a chance. I studied her reaction. She didn't look angry. She didn't reach for a Hot Wheel track like I thought she would. She didn't change her expression at all. She thought about it for a few seconds, then she responded, I believe it's important anything you tell me that you want to do with your life. But then her expression changed, and the mom hammer came down. But you've got 1 year to be productive and figure out how to take care of yourself this way. And if you can't do that, then you're going back to school. See, some people hate deadlines, but deadlines are motivation to get things done. My mom's support, along with the deadline, that made me more determined to find another way to make a living with laughter. A few days later, my mom handed me a check for next month's rent. She wanted just one thing in exchange for her support. She handed me a Bible and asked that I read it since I wasn't going to church with her anymore. I stopped by the Laugh House that night and I told Teray that I left my job. I had no income anymore and I didn't know what to do. It's not just the money, I explained. I told him I need to perform more just so I can get better. He said, it's good that you want to do that, but the best way to become better is through stage time. Well, how do I get that? He said, you know what, you can roll with me for a while and just see how it works. It was his third offer, and this time I was able to say yes. Besides talent and timing, success is also about work and relationships. Rolling with Teray was the first comedy relationship I built, and he quickly became a mentor. When Teray said stage time, you know, I imagine that we'd be driving to comedy clubs all over the East Coast. But he was inventing his own spots in Philadelphia. So some of those stages were just the corner of hamburger restaurants or the student center. I mean, Teray had become the comedy king of Philadelphia, and by doing this, he hosted in most of the clubs, and he was always looking out for new places to start comedy nights. The first room he took me to was a bowling alley. He put me on first. Nobody was paying attention. At the end of a joke, instead of hearing laughter, I heard crack! Strike! Whenever you can get a hold of a microphone to be around people, it's an opportunity to hone your act. That's what Teray told me that night after I expressed my disappointment. So never turn down those moments, he said. For months, no one on the scene knew my name. They just say to Teray, hey, who's the new guy with you? And Teray would respond, well, he's actually funny, man. I'm showing him around the scene. After I performed in a smaller room for a couple weeks, Teray let me do a guest spot on the weekend show at the Laugh House. A guest spot was just 5 minutes of stage time to add variety and to basically keep the audience warm between the more polished comedians. But to me, it was a big deal. See, surprisingly, it was easier than open mic. The house was packed with an audience paying to have a good time. None of them were friends with the comedians, and only the best comedians were performing. The room was buzzing with energy, and the audience was warmed up and ready to laugh. I went on stage that night and killed like I never killed before. My mom had tried to keep me away from the violence of the streets, but here I was trying to kill on stage and destroy them, murder the audience, crack people up, bust guts wide open. I still don't know why comedy is described in such violent terms. I mean, even if you don't do well on stage, it's not called failing or sucking. It's called bombing. I'm surprised the government's wiretapping programs haven't sent a lot of innocent comedians to Guantanamo. Hey, man, you going to the club? Yeah, man, I'm going to kill there. Yeah, well, I'll probably bomb. See, whenever I wasn't on stage, I was working on my Little Kev the Bastard persona, trying to create the best, most fun, most high-energy 5 minutes that I could possibly perform. I found that if I amplified the character of Lil' Kev, anything he said could be funny. I'd say things like, you ever take a bite of a potato for no reason? Then you look up and go, hey man, what happened to the potato? Everybody would laugh because my eyes would be bugged out and my voice is high-pitched. I'd dance for no reason at all, yell at the DJ, or say whatever nonsense came to my mind. See, as I grew more comfortable with the character, people on the scene started to notice. Hey man, that new guy's getting good. Our kids got a lot of potential. They weren't saying this because I was a great comedian, or even a good one. They were saying it because I was persistent. And that persistence was starting to show up in these small improvements. See, when you're trying to make it, you're not judged necessarily by your talent, but by your potential. And that potential is all about your willingness to listen, learn, and improve. The best gigs that Teray booked were the college shows. I mean, they each paid a few $100s, and as he noticed me improving, he began letting me open for him. See, I was too new and too raw to be doing those spots. But getting thrown into the deep end, it basically forced me to raise my game and get better. He slid me $25 a day for traveling with him, I mean, purely out of kindness. That was his money, and no one at those shows were there to see me. I mean, at one of those shows, there was a student from college on the bill named Naeem Lin. I was performing at his college, and he was also doing a set. I don't remember the comedy, just his beady eyes, and I had some big-ass eyes, which was always peering up at me, even though I was smaller than him. And he was quiet, real serious guy, like he was studying everything in life for a big exam. He knew my roommate. We met a few times before, so we started hanging out afterward. It was good to finally have a friend in my circle who was also new to the comedy scene. There was just one big obstacle standing in my way. It was money. Chapter 34. Oiling Up. Mom! Yo, where the rent at, Ma? I was a month behind on rent, and the next check was due the following day. Now, my mom had promised to support me, but she wasn't holding up her end of the deal. Are you reading your Bible? Mom, come on, man. I don't got time to talk about that. I'm late. I got to meet Teray. I need that rent money, Mom. I'm going to ask you again. Are you reading your Bible, Kevin? Look, I don't want to lie to my mom, so I told her the truth. No. No, I'm not, okay? But when you read your Bible, then we'll talk about rent. I was so pissed off, I just stormed out the house. Angry. Angry that she was trying to blackmail me. See, I hated studying. And the Bible was straight up work to me. Thou hasn't also taken thy fair jewels of my gold and my silver, which I have given thee, and the madest to thyself images of men, and didst commit whoredom with them. Somebody tell me what exactly is going on there. I mean, for 2 months rent, $400, I mean, come on, man, it was too much money to borrow from my friends. So, it was looking like I would have to work a day job again. It was the last thing that I wanted to do when I started to make a dent in the comedy scene, but my back was against the wall. I couldn't go to my brother for help, because he was struggling with the barbershop. The building had a glass storefront so that people passing by could see everyone working inside. And every now and then, he would glimpse Dad's face pressed against the glass staring. But as soon as my brother spotted him, Dad would disappear into the street. That's pretty much all we saw of our dad for a few years. I mean, I couldn't go to Tory for a loan because we got into an argument after I went to party one night and didn't answer her calls. So we temporarily broke up because I felt like I was losing my freedom. In that period, I started seeing someone else, very casually. And one day she came up with an idea. We're having a conversation. I'm telling her, I'm like, look, my mom playing around with the rent money. I got to do something. She said, you know what you should do? You should dance. What? You should dance. I mean, you small. You got a nice size package. You should dance. They'll love you. You say dance? What are you doing? You mean strip? Yeah, why not? I got a few girlfriends who dance and clean up, man. They make a lot of money. You're killing them. You think I would really do okay if I were to do that? If you want to do it, I'll get you right. The next day, I'm hanging out with my friend Zach, and I asked him, I say, oh, man, what do you think about the whole thing, this whole dancing thing I was telling you about? Zach was always down for pretty much anything, so naturally he responded, hey, man, you do it, I do it. Let's do it. I said, you don't want to talk about it? Nah, man, fuck that. We should do it. Well, let's talk to the chick and let's just get the breakdown of it. So I called her later that day, and she basically laid out the plan. She said, all I need is an hour of your time every day for like a week, and I get you guys comfortable with it. Then after that, y'all can go out there and make a lot of money. Shit, all right, fuck it. I need the money. Why not? I was desperate. I didn't know what to do. And Teray did say that the way to get better at comedy was through more stage time. She took Zach and me shopping, man. Once again, people, I cannot make this shit up, all right? She took us shopping, and with my last dollars, I bought a bow tie and a G-string and some Johnson & Johnson baby oil. Zach bought something equally ridiculous. We got back to my house, and class began. So the first lesson was about choosing a song. I picked Genuine's Pony. I think Zach chose something stupid. It was a Usher song. You Make Me Wanna. Yeah. Now, that's stupid. You shouldn't choose that song. The fact that we actually argued over what song should be chosen and not chosen showed how stupid we were for even considering this whole thing. You ain't gonna be able to dance to that, as if we knew who could do what to what. It was just a mess. Lesson two was about the choreography of a dance routine. I started working on some moves. Zach just stood there. I said, you better go get you a move. That's what you better do. I asked him, I said, what's your move? I said, yo, Zach, don't stand and watch my routine and try to steal my stuff. Now keep in mind, I don't want y'all thinking that we standing in the room with G-strings on. That's not what it was. Okay, we fully dressed. We got jeans and stuff on. We're just going over the dance routine, but I got to paint the picture so y'all know exactly what was going on. Okay, so you got that. So the first thing she asked me, she was like, what's your move? Zach was just standing there. So she looked at Zach. She was like, yo, what's your move? Like, what's your thing? Zach told her, he said, I only want to do bow-legged stuff. She gave him a funny look. I know that you've been looking at my legs. I'm not really bow-legged. I do this to get the attention from the girls, so I only want to do bow-legged moves. I laughed because I knew he was serious. She thought he was playing, which she found out later that he was not. Every dance move he tried started from a bow-legged stance. You ever see somebody do the cabbage patch bow-legged? It's the stupidest shit that you've ever seen in your life. Lesson number three was oiling up. We went to the bathroom. We doused ourselves with baby oil, right? And she was like, put on your stripper outfits. And I was like, what? Hold on, like, while we out here? She's like, you got to get comfortable. You got to do it. God damn. You going to put yours on, Zach? He's like, man, if she said we got to get comfortable, we got to get comfortable. All right, fuck it. We emerged. We looked like more victims of a fraternity prank than hot strippers. It was awful. By the way, right now I'm in shape. I can honestly say that I have a very nice physique. You don't know that you have a nice physique until you look at pictures when you had a bad physique. I didn't have a stripper body. There was nothing about my body that said tip me. Nothing. Nothing at all. Zach was worse than me. Zach looked like somebody aunt. I ain't never seen nothing like this. Zach looked like one of those bean bags. Like, not the big ones. But like when you sit in a bean bag and stuff just spill out on the side, that's what Zach looked like. I was like, brother, we should go to the gym tonight. If we trying to do this, what's our deadline? We need to do something. This ain't right. My G-string, listen, the G-string, my G-string was baggy. I was like, God, is this supposed to fit like this? She was like, no. She was so honest with me. No, it's not. That should be much tighter than that. Is this a small? It's an extra small. God damn it. I think I went too big. It was an elephant trunk. That was going to be my thing. You know, cause the trunk is where your package go. So my whole thing was going to be, you want to make the elephant go. Rrr. That was going to be my thing that I said to the girls. But I didn't fill up all that trunk, did I? I think I had too much trunk in there. I should have got an elephant with a smaller trunk. Whatever. Let's get back on. I'm just painting a picture so you guys can understand. So I'm like, yo, you sure this is how it works? She looked around the house with something. She's like, this right here, see this? This can be a girl. She placed a wooden stool in the middle of the room. She put on Pony. I started gyrating my body and running my hands over my chest to the song. This is so true. She said, it's cool, Zach. Go ahead, you can dance too. He joined me in the middle of the living room. Lights were blazing, Genuine pumping, were glistening. Zach got to the stool first. I'm standing behind him, shirt off, oiled up. I'm trying to do the R. Kelly move where he bends all the way backward until he looks like a table with two legs. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm gonna be honest with y'all. It didn't look sexy. It doesn't look sexy now, and it probably didn't at the time, especially because I didn't have half his flexibility, okay? When Zach finished doing the chair and I finished doing the table, we looked up and we saw my brother and my roommate and Spank and Naeem. And my upstairs neighbor, they were staring at us. The music was so loud that we hadn't even heard them come in. And now, with one exception, they're standing there, they doubled over, they breathless with laughter. Dying laughing. That exception was my brother, who was just pissed off. What the fuck is going on here? You know, he always felt protective of me. Throughout my whole life, he was constantly trying to help me become what he considered a man. And I let him down on that front pretty regularly. What does it look like? A single. That's what I yelled back at him. What does it look like? I'm standing there in a G-string and nothing else. We working, man. Working at what, Kevin? I said, girl, you can laugh all you want. But you'd do it, too, if you knew how much money strippers made. Say, you think anyone gonna pay to see that shit, Kevin? Man, the only thing they gonna pay for is therapy to get that fucking image out of my head. That was the end of my stripper days right there. Started and ended right there. Walked my dumb ass to the bathroom, took that G-string off, flushed it down the toilet. Which stopped my toilet up, by the way. So I ended up having another expense. Chapter 35. Salvation. After I was 2 months late with rent, the landlord put an eviction notice on the door. I visited my mom begging. I was like, Mom, okay, listen, I just got an eviction notice. I need to pay the rent. I'm serious, Mom. Have you read the Bible, Kevin? Look, this time I just lied to her. I mean, when your survival is at stake, morality is the first thing to go out the window. Yes. Yes, Mom. Don't lie to me, Kevin. Talk to me after you read your Bible. She must have had a sixth sense. Mom, whatever. Okay, look, I don't want to talk about scriptures. Just forget it. Forget it. I slammed the door shut. I was so angry that she bailed on her part of the bargain, man. But of course she had it. It was me who broke my word. I got home and I figured I'd open the Bible and pray for guidance. Maybe Mom knew something I didn't. I pulled it out the drawer and I opened it up for the first time since she's given it to me. When I opened up the Bible, a stack of rent checks, all signed and dated for the first of each month for the whole year, fell out. She kept her promise after all. I felt so low and ungrateful. That she was a tough woman and she was always true to her word. I never expected to fall on such hard times. I mean, once I finally found my passion and made a plan, I thought I was set. That's how it works, right? You make a plan, work hard to execute it, and then succeed. But I've learned that I'm not the only person in the world who's making plans. Everyone is reaching for what they believe is a better future, and not all of those futures are in alignment. Some people's plans conflict directly with the plans of others. In a basketball game, both teams are planning to win, but only one gets to succeed. Now add to this mess of plans the forces that are beyond our control. See, there's so much that is greater than us, whatever you believe. So while you get to choose the roads we take, we don't get to know where they lead. Acceptance then is knowing that when your plan fails, or your road dead ends, it means a bigger plan is at work. And I'd rather be a part of a big plan than a small one. So I cracked that Bible open and I read the entire book of Genesis and Exodus on the spot. And I called my mom and apologized with all my heart. Mom, I'm so sorry. I just began reading the Bible and I found my salvation. That Bible will serve you better than those checks, she replied. You're going to need to stay faithful if you want to succeed on your journey. My mom had a funny way of doing things, and even in my darkest days, she was able to turn those hard times into lessons or cast a positive light on them. Even when things got negative in her own life, she stood tall as a model of optimism and resiliency. Out of respect for her, I started reading scriptures every day for years after that. And pretty soon a miracle happened. Life lessons from apprenticeship. You need a teacher, because those that can't do, teach. So if you want to learn something, go to someone who can't do it. Damn it, wait, I did it again. I think I wrote it wrong. I did. I wrote that wrong. Shit, well, it's in there now. That's got to stay, guys. We're just going to keep it. Chapter 36. I'm running out of chapter titles. How many more chapters do you think I have? Because I don't... Fuck me, man. This is going to be called Fuck Me, then. All right, I'm going to keep it. Kev. You like getting your dick sucked, don't you? That's what my dad asked me out of nowhere. Yeah. Well, have you ever had your dick sucked on crack? What the hell, Dad? I can't say that I have, Dad. Yeah, well, that's how it happened. I was fucking around with this chick after your mom and I split up, and she told me to try it. Let me tell you something, she was right. It was the best dick sucking I ever got. Okay, Dad. I did it again, son. I did it again and again until I realized that it wasn't her that was so good. It was the crack. Okay, Dad, what is it that I'm supposed to take away from that story? That's a good question, son. I don't know. The shit came up in my head, so I asked the question. If you weren't here, I probably would just talk to myself about it. My father was back in my life. I mean, listen, it was the last thing that I expected. We were sitting in the kitchen of my mom's house, having his version of a heart-to-heart talk. He said that with those magic rocks, he's gained the power to sleep with the women who were way out of his league. He said they would do anything for crack. He said all he was trying to do was get his dick sucked more, but he got hooked. Evidently, in the crevice of my dad's brain that wasn't clouded by crack smoke, he had a conscience. See, a few weeks after he stole my brother's car and the barbershop supplies, he asked for help from my local priest who'd been trying to get him to quit drugs. Since then, he'd been in and out of rehab. I've been working hard in the interim to get my brother to forgive him, track him down, and just see if we can get him help. Eventually, we found him at a rehab program in Mount Airy. We went to visit him there and told him that whatever he needed to stay committed to the process that we were ready to do. And now he was back, man. As we sat in the kitchen where he once lived and cooked grits, Dad opened up for the first time that I could remember. I listened to every word closely. I'm just piecing together the puzzle of my father, man. When he said, y'all got no idea what it's like to get all tricked up with crack and be treating all these people in the crack house to everything you got, and then they won't buy you a damn 25-cent bag of potato chips. I mean, I tried to understand. When he said, I thought I could turn it off and on like a faucet. Then I discovered that the faucet was broke. You understand what I'm saying? Now I'm done with that shit. And I got a clear head. And I'm going to tell y'all something. I don't miss it. When he said that, I believed him. When he said, y'all want to hang out or something? I knew that we were going to have a great relationship again. Though my brother still understandably held a grudge, I didn't. I mean, the man had made an effort to clean himself up and face his family. He was still my dad, and that crazy-ass person, I loved him. With my brother and my father back in town, I had something like a family again. I could pick up the phone and call or see them anytime. Dad was sober, Mom was happy, Kenneth owned a business, and I had direction in my life. Things were looking up for your humble narrator, and they were about to get even better. Chapter 37. 5 chapter titles ago, I referred to myself in the third person. Does that make me seem egotistical? That's a real question. For a solid year, I slugged it out in the clubs and bars, hamburger restaurants and fish fry places, bowling alleys, community centers. I didn't just rely on Touré for work. Every time I met a comedian, I asked if I could open for him. I was never afraid to approach them with my hand out. The worst thing they could say is no. And if they did, then I'd stop by their shows and support them anyway. Often they'd come around and that no would turn into a yes. I went from making no money in a week to $50 to $70 to $90. Once I hit that number, I felt good. I was earning more than I budgeted when I left City Sports. Enough to pay my rent after my mom's checks ran out. See, this was possible because of a plus-size, foul-mouthed character named Big Jay Oakerson. Man, I've become friends with Jay. Jay lived in New Jersey and had something that I sorely lacked. He had a car. So every time I got booked as a headliner, I'd make sure to get Jay a guest spot too so I'd have a ride. Being able to accept more gigs meant being able to accept more money. Big Jay was the only white comedian I saw at the time doing black rooms and getting love. At least most of the time. I mean, once I saw the dude tell him, shut up, white boy! Man, it was so much hatred. Jay, when he said it, Jay just said, good night. And he walked off the stage. We were finishing the show at South Philly one night when Touré told us, he said, look, Def Comedy Jam, which at the time was the biggest thing in the world, they were hosting a competition. Bob Sumner, who was one of the creators of the show with Russell Simmons, he was there and he was going to be judging the comedians. He was known as the star maker. So every comic in the city signed up. Me, Touré, Big J, Tommy Too Smooth, Michael Shawn, Jamal Dolman, Denny Lyre, Michael Blackston, a.k.a. the African King of Comedy. The prize was $500 in a personalized Def Comedy Jam Championship jacket. But more important than the jacket, or the bragging rights that went with the jacket, the winner got an opening slot on the actual tour when it came through Philadelphia. Oh, man. See, this was a chance to perform on a stage with Earthquake, D.L. Hughley, A.J. Johnson from the movie Friday, and other national headliners. Before the competition, the other comics were intensely focused. They had headphones on and notepads out and were busy warming up as if it was the Super Bowl of comedy. What worried me most of all was that this was a real contest. Def Jam had its own judges who would determine the 3 finalists. And then one winner. I was on 4th. When the stakes are higher than what they're used to, there's one rule. Go with what you know. Don't change it up. Because when you start performing new stuff instead of polished stuff, you're more likely to bomb. I did my tight 5 minutes, and let me tell you something, I destroyed people. The three finalists were me, T-Ray, and Tommy Too Smooth. Word got around, and 2 weeks later, we performed for a pack house. That night, people, I was chosen as the Def Comedy Jam competition winner. My brother was there. My friends from City Sports were there. My buddies from the neighborhood were there. Tori, who I was dating again, was there. Even my dad was there, though he slept through my set. Afterwards, he gave me the kind of encouragement that only a father can. I don't think it was that good, Kev. Dad, I saw you sleeping through the set. Well, if it was better, I wouldn't have went to sleep. I would have kept my eyes open, despite my dad's words. That day was the first time my brother said that he was proud of me. I mean, when it comes to family and friends, either they believe in you right away before you've ever done anything, or they're your toughest critics and your last ones to offer you praise. Those words from my brother further skyrocketed my mood that day, that week, that month. The only person who didn't see me win was my mom, because she was turning her life over to God more and more each year. She didn't want to hear me using obscenities and talking about sexual or violent situations. And she definitely didn't want to go to a place where people drank so much alcohol. However, I wasn't upset about it. It's a true act of love to believe in someone and support them wholeheartedly, even though you don't morally or ethically agree with them. At the end of the night, I mean, look, I was given a championship jacket, but it was Bernie Mac sized. I was practically swimming in it. They promised to get one custom made with my name on it. 4 weeks I waited for that jacket to arrive in the mail. Let me tell you something, it never came. In the meantime, I wore the oversized jacket every day. People accused me of lying about winning the contest and stealing somebody else's coat. But because it had Def Comedy Jam winner emblazoned on the back and I knew that winner was me, no drug could have gotten me higher and no intervention could have brought me down until I met Keith Robinson. Chapter 38. Or is it more egotistical that 5 chapters ago later, I'm still worried about how it made me look? Maybe that's a question to myself. I wasn't the new guy in Philadelphia anymore. Everyone knew my name. Comedians who never spoken to me before would come up and say, "Congratulations, man." People would never see me perform or saying I was funny, just because that's what everyone else was saying. And I was taking every show I could hustle because I needed all the stage time I could get to prepare for when the Def Comedy Jam Tour came to town. I took so many shows that I started making more money. So when Paul lost his job and tried to steal from Tori's purse to pay the rent, I decided it was time to start living alone. I carefully prepared a budget and determined that if I continue to work this hard, I could afford $400 for rent plus another $100 for utilities and other expenses. On a Saturday night a few weeks before Def Comedy Jam show, I stopped by the Laugh House where a local comedian named Keith Robinson was headlining. Now, although I never met Keith, he'd been around for a while and he was one of the most respected performers on the local scene. He'd acted in a TV movie with Don Cheadle. I mean, I think he even performed on Star Search back when I was in elementary school. Keith is old, for the record. I strutted up to him at the beginning of the night wearing my Def Jam jacket. And I asked him for a guest spot, which I was sure he would give me because, you know, because of the aforementioned jacket. "Can I get a spot tonight?" He said, "What's your name, young fella?" He said it in what had to be the most grating voice to ever rub my ear. I told him, I said, "Little Kev the Bastard." I was proud of that name. He said, "The Bastard? Screw his face up. That's fucking horrible." He wasn't playing when he said it either. He was serious. I said, "Well, Jesus Christ, tell me how you really feel." I smiled. You know, I'm assuming that he's playing around. But he said it again. "It's fucking horrible. Your name, stupid. What's your name?" I'm sitting there with a blank look on my face. I said, "Kevin." He still doesn't respond. I said, "Kevin Hart. Much better. I want to see what you got, young fella. Yeah, go ahead. You can get a guest spot." And there were several other comedians there jockeying for stage time. But he shut them down and said, "I'm only giving this kid here a guest spot." I was in great form from all my practicing that I've been doing. So I went on stage and boom, boom, boom. I'm hitting them. Hitting them with every joke I had. I mean, look, it was Saturday night. This place was thick with laughter. After the set, I asked Keith, I said, "What'd you think?" And I was certain that I impressed him with my young, raw talent. And, you know, I was waiting for the praise to roll in. He said, "It was awful." Huh? In all this time, no one had said anything that direct and harsh to me. especially not an older established comedian. He said, you're not talking about shit. I'm not getting to know who you are. What do you mean? You just saw me. Everyone was laughing. He said, so what? People laugh at anything. You're doing black crowd tricks, son. That's what you're doing. Comedy is about experimentation. You're rehearsing corny bits that have already been done and will always work. It's TV dinner comedy, prepackaged. I'm not gonna lie to y'all, his words hurt, but I try not to show it. Stop catering to the audience and start working on being a comedian, young fella. I tried to respond, but I couldn't get any words out. I just beat out all the other comedians in Philly. I had to at least have something going for me. Then after that he said, now I definitely saw some pizzazz. I saw a solid stage presence and a lot of energy, but none of that set was about you. So it meant nothing. Now there's only so much abuse that a person can take. I mean, honestly, who was this guy to come out of nowhere and tell me to change my whole act? You tell him your real name. He slapped me on the back hard. He said, trust me, to take you further than to sharpen you up. Stay and watch my set. I stuck around. I saw Keith perform. His entire routine was about him. His life, his point of view, his family. He told jokes about his mom and his brother, sharing insights about them. I mean, it was so specific. They had to be true. Unlike me, he was very relaxed on stage. He wasn't afraid to take a long pause and let things settle. He didn't seem to be putting on a persona so much as sharing his own personality at its best. He was right. Compared to him, I looked like an amateur who was trying too hard. I decided that night to try letting go of my comedy name. When there are no consequences taking someone's advice, then there's no reason not to test it out and see if it works. In the days that followed, I told a host to introduce me as Kevin Hart. And I discovered that while Keith's advice worked for him, it didn't work for me. I had no swag as Kevin Hart. I wasn't interesting as Kevin Hart. I wasn't funny as Kevin Hart. I mean, just imagine, you're on a date, you're at a comedy club, you're both a little nervous and hoping to have a special night together, a night to remember. You've never heard of the performance, but your friend promised you that this club was good. Someone comes out and says, I'm Kevin Hart, what up? Someone else comes out and says, I'm Lil' Kev the Bastard, what up? I mean, be honest, which one of those is going to get you more hyped? Have you smiling at your date with a look in your eyes that says, see, I told you this place was fun. From the start, Lil' Kev the Bastard is just funnier. He has attitude, he has presence, he's memorable, he's original. He doesn't give a fuck. You're ready to laugh at the little bastard. When I was Kevin Hart, none of those bits that I did as Lil' Kev the Bastard were funny. Kevin Hart was dull compared to crazy-ass, loud-mouth, unpredictable Lil' Kev the Bastard. I was nothing without the name. And with the Def Jam show coming up in a week, I needed to follow my own advice and not change up and act the last minute. I didn't want to bomb in front of thousands of people. So I ended the experiment and dropped Keith's advice. Fuck you, Keith. So you going back to Lil' Kev the Bastard? Yup. I mean, I tried what Keith said because he was so cocky about it, man, but that Kevin Hart shit just don't work for me. He rolled his eyes. He said, that's right, because you've been doing comedy longer than anyone here, so you're the expert now. I got to be doing something right. I won the Def Jam competition. That's because you're new and young, okay? You don't know who you want to be yet. I tried not to listen to his words. It was like dropping poison into my ears right before the biggest show of my life. Maybe they all were just jealous of the new kid that was eclipsing them. I'm embarrassed I thought that. But those first wins can go to your head, man. More importantly, I couldn't afford to have any self-doubt and fuck my game up before the show. So I hid behind overconfidence and arrogance. On a big night, I got a ride to the Leacor Center with Tory. Def Jam said that they didn't have enough extra tickets for me to give to my friends, but they had my name on the backstage list plus one. Which was even cooler to me. I mean, I spent whatever remained of my savings on a rayon shirt, dress pants, and black patent leather shoes. Oh, I was feeling like I was on top of the world. When we arrived, I saw security guards outside with walkie-talkies and tons of people rushing around backstage. It wasn't just a show. It was a well-oiled machine run by what must have been 100 people. At every other show I've been to, the comedians had almost no support. Maybe there'd be a host. I mean, who was usually also doing sound and lighting and sometimes a separate DJ. But at the Leacor Center, I couldn't even imagine what jobs all those people could do. I walked through the corridor looking at the names posted on the doors. I saw D.L. Hughley, Earthquake, A.J. Johnson. But there was no door for Lil' Kev the Bastard. In fact, everyone was ignoring me. Tori and I just wandered around looking lost backstage. I started to get nervous. I mean, did they know I was supposed to open the show? Oh, my God, what have they forgotten? I finally found Bob Sumner in the office where he was talking with three other people. He greeted me without enthusiasm to introduce me to someone he identified as a production manager and told me to stay close to him. Tori and I followed the production manager around, still ignored and feeling like we were in the way, until finally we arrived at a little area just to the side of the stage. All right, it's showtime, that's what the production manager said. I stood there waiting to be announced. I said it's showtime. All the house lights were on, people were still arriving, getting drinks in the lobby and finding their seats. The host hadn't even come on stage to announce the show. I was totally confused. What? I mean, well, isn't someone supposed to announce me or something? Just get out there and do your 5 minutes. Okay. So now no one was announcing me. At best, I was warming up the audience for the show host. At worst, the contest was just a promotional stunt to boost ticket sales, and now they were stuck with an amateur comedian who had put on stage without ruining the show. I had hoped that they at least turned the sound system on for me. All the confidence I gained from winning the competition drained out of me, leaving a trail of sweat from the backstage to the center of the stage. Hey, everyone! That's how I started. So many people in the audience were talking to each other and making noise that I couldn't even hear the sound of my own voice in the theater. I had no idea whether the sound system was on or not. I felt tiny and invisible. I pushed forward with my set and worked my heart out, doing all the material that had gotten me there. Some folks were looking at the stage, but in the same way people at the movie theaters look at the advertisements before the show. I could count on my hand the number of people who had laughed that night. Thank you, Philly. That's how I ended. I love you, Philly. I heard a smattering of polite applause as I walked to the wings of the stage, dejected. No one said a word except Tori, who gave me a pity pat. Everyone else was running around getting ready for the actual show to start. I felt like I would have gotten more laughs if I had just stood on the car in the parking lot and done my set. My big moment was over. I mean, as much as I wanted to go home and hide from the world, I didn't want the moment to end. I didn't know if I'd ever be back there again. So I asked the production manager if I could stay and see the rest of the show. I stood on the side of the stage and watched each comic kill on a level I'd never witnessed before. They were so tight, authentic, and masterful that even when they paused to breathe, they had the audience screaming with laughter. I'd never seen up close and in person comedy of that level of mastery and control before. Even Tori was dying with laughter. I looked at her double up and thought sadly, she doesn't even laugh at me like that. In that moment, I understood that I had been given the slot I deserved. I wasn't good enough yet. In the small bubble of the Laugh House and the Philadelphia scene, maybe I stood out. But it was like standing out in a high school play. It wasn't the real world of entertainment. The stage I was on at these tiny clubs was the size of a subcompact parking space. This was a real venue with a stage the size of a barn. I was long away from being able to perform on this scale and at this level of professionalism. Even as an opening act. As humbled as I was, I knew one thing. I needed to somehow get from here to there. I wanted to be as funny, natural, and as polished as the headlining comedians there. I wanted to be as successful as them. I wanted to be playing on stages that big every night. I wanted to make as much money as they were probably making. And I wanted to make my girlfriend laugh that hard. Watching the Def Jam show from behind the scenes filled me with an ambition that I never felt before. It raised the ceiling on what I thought was possible and where this all could lead. As we walked out, I thought, I gotta get it together so I can be there one day. For the first time, I didn't just have a path that I was excited to be on. I had a destination. Chapter 39, Staying True to My Fan Base. Now what? After experiencing the scale and energy of the Def Comedy Jam tour, it was hard going back to the same clubs, bars, and random spots in Philly. It started to feel like the top rung in town was a weekend headlining slot at the Laugh House. But that wouldn't get me to the place Earthquake and D.L. Hughley were at. I couldn't understand how I was supposed to reach that level, or how anyone did. Was I supposed to just keep performing until the next contest came to town? I was only 20, and it felt like I was already peaking. I needed to figure out the next step. What did I tell you, stupid? That was when Keith Robinson came back into my life. I had recognized that voice from anywhere. I just stepped off stage at the Laugh House, closing with the usual, I'm Lil' Kev the Bastard, thank you and good night. Stop telling people that you're Lil' Kev the Bastard, stupid. A nasal voice drilled into my skull. I told him that I'd taken his advice, but it wasn't working for me. I mean, audiences didn't find Kevin Hart nearly as funny as the little Kev the Bastard. Sit down. I sat down obediently. Let me ask you a question. How many people do you think are going to remember Lil' Kev the Bastard? Shit, I mean, my whole fan base, man. My fan base was like 20 people. Okay, then. Tell me some comedians with nicknames who are stars. Earthquake, Cedric the Entertainer, Sinbad. I said stars. Those people are great entertainers. Those people are great comedians. But I said stars. People that are worldwide. People that are globally known household names for telling jokes. Name just four people. I thought of the legends. Eddie Murphy, Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor, George Carlin. None had stage names. I don't know. He said, that's my point. That may work for you in the short term, but you're cutting off an entire group of people that may not get Lil' Kev the Bastard. If you wanted to be a wrestler or a rapper, Lil' Kev the Bastard would be fine. However, you want to have a relationship with the audience, and the name that you were born with is going to have more authenticity than the character that you made up. Yeah, I sighed that. On an intuitive level, though, because I knew that he was right. But I didn't want to start all over as Kevin Hart and throw away the work that I'd done so far. I could see the doubt in your eyes. Keith grew more impassioned, leaning in a little too close. Stop being a dummy. Your job as a person with talent is to make yourself interesting after the audience hears your name. Define the person who was just introduced. Yo, how do you do that? It's simple, stupid. You be yourself. When they say Kevin Hart, your first word should be, hey, what's going on? My name is Kevin Hart. I'm happy to be here. It felt like he just told me to pull down my pants and take a crap on stage. In fact, taking the on stage shit would have made more sense to me. At least that was interesting and memorable. Starting out by greeting the audience like I was at a job interview made absolutely no sense. But I was willing to try it again. I can do that, I guess. It's a long journey to find yourself. Just go on that journey. It's worth it. He advised me to stick around and watch him perform again. I paid attention as he did exactly what he suggested I do. And I noticed that because of it, he was coming across more like the stars I'd seen at the Def Comedy Jam show than like me or Tommy Too Smooth with our gimmicks. And that's when I got it. I could be funny for 10 minutes at my best. Same with most of the other new guys on the scene. But when Keith started talking, you felt like you could listen to him for hours. He wasn't delivering material or playing characters. He was just being himself. It was a radical concept. After his set, he hung around talking to audience members and other comedians. Then after that, he returned to the table where I was sitting. He slapped my head and spoke the words that would change my life. If you're really serious about this, then you gotta get out of here. Philadelphia isn't the place that's gonna make you better. You gotta get to New York. It's the comedy club capital of the world. Your game has to seriously rise up to make it there. My eyes widened and my heart raced. Man, I'd love to. How do I do that? He wrote down his phone number on a napkin, handed it to me and said, if you're serious about going to New York, you call me and I'll take you there. I couldn't believe this guy was inviting me to New York out of the blue. Either this was an opportunity to move toward the goal I set at the Def Comedy Jam show or a total scam. He could be a pervert for all I knew, trying to get me alone on an isolated road with his pulled up too high dress slacks and some creepy goatee he had. I mean, he kind of did look like a guy who hung around playgrounds and pretending to read the newspaper. You know what those guys look like. The creepy perverts that dress too nice, but it's not nice, but it's nice. It's like a nice version of nice that's not nice. You know what I'm talking about? It's stupid, but then they got a belt, so you're like, all right, it's cool. I had to make a choice. Risk getting in the car with a stranger or risk missing out on what could be the biggest opportunity of my career. There was only one path that I could reasonably take, and it wasn't one that my mother would have approved. Chapter 40, Little Kev versus Big Kev. I called Keith the next day and told him I was ready to go to New York. You got a car? Nope, but my friend does. Meet me at 4 at the 7-Eleven on City Line Avenue. Bring the car, stupid. I hung up, I called Big J Ogerson. Yo, we got to go to New York. I just met this guy. He's saying that's where we need to be. He said to call him when I'm serious, and I just called him. Jay agreed to come with me. I mean, since it would be an opportunity for him as well. A few hours later, he picked me up and we drove to City Line Avenue. Keith parked his car in a lot there and jumped into Jay's car. As we drove to New York, Keith broke down the scene for us. We're going to go to the city where all the best comics are. This is the big league. The goal is to make everyone think you live there. You got to be the first one in. You got to be the last one out. You got it, dummies? When we arrived, he directed us to a place called the New York Comedy Club in Gramercy Park. He ran inside while we found parking, then we met him at the club and watched his set. As soon as he finished, he had us drive him to the Boston Comedy Club in Greenwich Village, and he did the same thing. Next, we drove him to Gotham Comedy Club in Chelsea to watch him do the same jokes all over again. What about us? I finally broke down and asked that after the Gotham show. Are we getting up anywhere? Y'all need to see what this is first, he responded. And here's what that was. More comedy clubs than I could ever imagine in the city. More talented comedians than I'd seen in the night. A seemingly endless supply of audience members and a total lack of parking spaces. We must have chauffeured Keith to 7 comedy clubs that night. We spent most of the time searching for parking. When he finally finished around 1 in the morning, he took us to a brick wall basement club called the Comedy Cellar. The show had ended for the night, and upstairs there were a few lingering customers and a table full of loud comedians who greeted Keith as he entered. I recognized some of them from television, Patrice O'Neill, Rich Voss, Jim Norton, Bill Burr. Keith led us to an empty table. Y'all hungry? Order y'all some food. Go ahead. I'll take care of it. Then he stood up, headed to the long, dirty drink-filled table full of loud comics. Can we sit with you, I asked? No, that's the table. It's for real comedians. Y'all ain't qualified to sit there. He walked off, leaving Big J and me by ourselves. What the fuck is this, man? That's what Jay griped. This is a waste of time, Kev. He ain't even let us get on stage. I tried to be positive about it, but after sitting there for another 90 minutes while Keith completely ignored us, I had to agree. We took him everywhere he wanted to go. Now he pretending like we don't even exist. Around 3 in the morning, Keith decided to notice us again. Come on, y'all, he said. Let's go. We didn't say a word as we shuffled back to the car. What did you dummies see tonight? Keith is in high spirits. He asked us as we began the long drive home. We said nothing. I'm going to ask y'all again, what did y'all see? Did anything pop to y'all? Man, we saw you perform 7 times. You ain't even talked to us. That's what I finally told him. I saw a lot of taxis trying to hit my fucking car. That's what Big J said. That's all you saw. Open your eyes, dummies. What you saw was a comedian get on stage 7 different times and work on his material 7 different ways. You saw a community of comedians. And you saw how many comedy clubs? A lot. That's what I said. Yeah, but why couldn't we get on stage? It's not about you getting on stage, stupid. It's about you seeing what's out there. This is the world where you need to be if you want to make it. I can easily get you guys into these clubs, but I'm not using my good name to help nobody that's not serious and not making this a number one priority. We are serious. We just think that we should have had a chance to get up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Get serious about learning. They spit on me for years before I could even think of getting up somewhere. I said, okay, all right, okay. Well, we're serious about learning. Then if you're serious, then keep rolling with me, and everything will fall into place. All right. Jay agreed, too. All right. Then after that, Keith fell asleep and didn't wake up until we pulled up next to his car. We drove Keith to and from New York 4 different times in the next week. The following week, it was another 4 days. I mean, each trip was the same. We watched him perform in some 6 clubs, sat around like sullen children while he talked to famous people at the Comedy Cellar. And after that, we drove him back to Philadelphia while he slept in the back seat. It was some Mr. Miyagi shit. When Keith finally deigned to introduce us to friends in the scene, it was solely just to tease me about my stage name and make the point that Lil' Kev the Bastard wouldn't fit in at the table with people like Patrice O'Neill, Jim Norton, and Bill Burr. On a long ride home that night, instead of crashing out, Keith spent the whole time talking to me. He said the reason he offered to take me to New York was because he seen me bombing on material that I wasn't sure about. The fact that I was testing myself and trying out new material let him know that I had potential. If only I would get rid of what he called the hacky pandering garbage. The main thing is to come from heart, he went on. Say something that matters rather than stuff you think the crowd wants to hear, and you won't go wrong. Even if it doesn't go over well, all that matters is you. Yeah, but what should I do to make that stuff funny without pandering? Just tell the truth. And after that, you work your way to funny from there. See, when you let them in on what's really going on with you, you automatically find the jokes in there. Well, what's an example of someone who does that? Look at Richard Pryor. while he's still unanimously the number one comic. Sometimes life is brutal, and he isn't afraid to come out with his truth and say it. When he changed his mind about things, he wasn't afraid to tell people he didn't feel the same way anymore. Just speak what you know, dummy. I lived in the projects back in 1980, but they're not the same now. So I don't speak about them and pretend like I know what it's like to grow up there today. My heels were still dug in a little, so I told him some of the things that I was worried about. Losing momentum, not being memorable, not being funny. I get it, he replied. If you have pretty girls in the audience, you don't want to bomb in front of them. And a black crowd will always give you a nice booing. But you got to look at the bigger picture, which is growth. See, I've been through all the stuff that you're going through, and I had the same worries. So trust me when I tell you that you're going to get worse at first, and then you're going to get better. Much better. On my free nights, I tried taking his advice. Started performing as Kevin Hart again, and I struggled every single time. What's up, y'all? I begin. I'm Kevin Hart. The audience would stare at me blankly. Felt like I was forcing myself to be normal. I'd gotten so used to being a clown on stage that I didn't know how to be myself. I wasn't connecting with anyone in the audience. And being exhausted from all those late nights in New York didn't help either. I asked Teray for advice. You're still trying too hard, he said. Just talk how you talk. Can't nobody steal that. Be Kevin, man. And whatever you think is funny, is just going to have to be funny. I felt like I was at war with myself. See, Lil' Kev was like, don't listen to these guys, man. They're trying to fuck up your game. But then Kevin said, but remember the graduation dinner? That was just me being me, and everyone loved that. Lil' Kev came right back, yeah, but those fools were your teammates. They knew you. At these here clubs, nobody knows you. You gotta explode and grab them by the goddamn throat. Keep them laughing. But what about city sports, Lil' Kev? I had new customers cracking up and loving me there every day without even trying. Oh, come on, look how far we come together. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You're not enough on your own. You need me. You need the bastard. Kevin said, wait, no. No, what's the point of even doing this if I can't be me? What I should do is stop using you like a crutch and trust that I'm able and funny just as I am, whether I'm talking to one person or 100. After that conversation with myself, I exhaled, and 50 pounds of pressure seemed to be lifted off me. It was like an epiphany or an exorcism or a punch in the back of my damn head. I knew that Lil' Kev the bastard was dead. The problem is that Kevin Hart still needed to come to life. I'll never forget the day that that happened and I learned how to be myself on stage, because my life depended on it. Chapter 41, Not Afraid to Be Afraid. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but my chapter titles are getting good again. It was a Tuesday, which was always a dead night at the Laugh House, but it was a chance to get some stage time in and make a little money during the day off from New York. Audience was usually a smattering of comedians and their friends, with Teray claiming the night as the host. I arrived there with Spank and Naeem, and I sat in the back with the regular comedians, Buck Wild, Sean Clayton, and Tommy Too Smooth. The room was nearly empty otherwise, except for a small group of rowdy guys just sitting at the center table in front of the house, yelling at Teray as he was trying to host. Yo, man, I know those guys. That's what Spank nudged me. He said, hey, man, they some bad dudes. They off from Richard Allen Projects. Teray did his best to keep it together on stage, but he was clearly rattled. All right, man, look, you know, we're going to get this show started and have a good time. Who's ready to have a good time? Hey, man, shut the fuck up and just bring up the next nigga. God damn. That's what one of the guys just yelled. I looked longingly at the exit and tried to think of a possible excuse I could make to leave, or at least not to perform. I didn't know how to handle these guys, because they were at a level far beyond heckling. They weren't there to laugh, but they were there to start something that neither I nor anyone else there could finish. Sean Clayton went on first, and they went after him instantly. You a weak-ass nigga. That's what one of the guys yelled out. Sean said, yes, I am a weak-ass nigga. I know that, because I used to run from y'all. They laughed, but I looked up at Sean, and he wasn't laughing. My hands began trembling, and before I could stop it, my next thought was, Mom, help me. I'd never before, as an adult, been so scared that I wanted to run to my mama. Fuck this. I'm going up there. That's what Buck Wild said bravely after Sean's set ended. I felt like those might be his last words. On stage, he had a fast-talking, rough-voiced street persona, complete with cheap gold-colored jewelry. I think his confidence that night came from the mistaken belief that he had street cred and would be able to relate to these guys on their level. You know, y'all niggas in here trying to stunt on me. You better back off, because we all trying to get money in here, you know what I'm saying?